Okay, very good. So, glad to see you all still here. I was a bit concerned after this morning you might have, the ranks might have been diluted. So, that's good. So, from here on it's going to be much easier. The most kind of philosophical part, if you like, was what we did this morning. And from now on it's going to be, I think, fairly straightforward and not so profound, profound in some ways, but not in the kind of same way as it was this morning here. So hopefully that will be better and more practical, the things that we're going to look at from here onwards. Okay, so there is one sutta which is coming up next year, which I will drop, because it's more of the same thing really here. And I thought of just bypassing that one. When I put this thing together, I wasn't all that. I sort of just took out a few sutta that I thought might be useful. And I think now we'll just drop this one. So the one which is called, If There Is Lust, we'll just leave that one out. And then we'll move on to the next one, which comes afterwards. Okay, so so far we have been looking at how this delusion, the avidya, leads to all these activities, and from the activities we set up consciousness at a certain level, the mind at a certain level, and then when there's rebirth, we get reborn according to that level, and then we experience the world, our experiences are according to the level of that rebirth. That's the first kind of four factors of dependent arising here. And of course, as a consequence of that, as a consequence of getting reborn and having this materiality and mentality of the name and form, an aspect of that is the senses, right? The ability to see the world in various ways, through hearing, through sight or whatever. And the number of senses we have will depend on the kind of rebirth we have, right? So if you get reborn in a realm of samadhi realm, there will only be the realm of the mind, only the mental sense will be left. Whereas in most realms you have all six senses in operation. So the sense spaces will vary, and also the quality of the sense spaces will obviously vary enormously depending on where you are reborn. So nama rupa then gives rise to the sense spaces and what sort of sense spaces we have and the quality. And this is what this next sutta is saying here. So they're back now to dependent origination again. Name and form is the condition for the six sense spaces. And the six sense spaces in turn are the condition for contact. Then we have the reverse. With the cessation of name and form, there is the cessation of the six sense spaces. And with the cessation of the six sense spaces, there is the cessation of contact. And here you can see in the next sutta here how it is described, how these things are defined. And again, the definitions are not all that useful because basically the definitions are there to tell you that the six sense spaces is everything within experience. And what bhikkhus are the six sense spaces? Or the six sense fields, perhaps, or the six sense spheres. The eye field, the ear field, the nose field, the tongue field, the body field, and the mind field. These are called the six sense spaces. The mind field, that sounds a bit dangerous, the last one there. And then we have the contact. The contact, there are the six classes of contact. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. This is called contact. So here we just see that these things encompass everything there is within experience. So when we have the six sense spaces, or we have a subset of that, one or two or three, how many sense spaces we have, then it is through those that we contact the world. And contacting the world just means experiencing the world, right? Every time we experience something, it is an instance of contact. We are the external world, the object and the mind come together and we experience something. That's really all contacting is, contacting the world. We're not secluded. That's why when you go into a state of samadhi, it says you are secluded from the senses, right? That is because you're no longer contacting those senses in samadhi. The senses are out of range, they're outside of your ability to experience. This is one way you can see the ending of certain contacts when the meditation gets deeper. You can experience that. And what does it feel like? It feels great, right? Less contact. Wow, it's really good news. Let's have less contact, because it creates all kind of problems when you have to have all these experiences all the time. So these are the next steps here. And now, again, I will go back to the great discourse on origination, the Mahanidana Sutta. It talks about this. And again, the language here is a little bit philosophical, but actually the concept, the ideas here are actually not that difficult to understand. So just bear with me, and we'll see how this happens, what happens here. So it says, it was said, with mentality, materiality, or if with name and form, if you like, as condition, there is contact. So here they are dropping out the six sense spaces in between, but that doesn't really make any difference. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body or the mind were all absent, would designation contact be discerned in the material body? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the material body, if they were all absent, would impingement contact be discerned in the mental body? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the mental body and the material body were all absent, would either designation contact or impingement contact be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of a name and form, mentality, materiality, if all those were absent, would contact be discerned at all? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, the source, the origin and condition for contact, namely name and form, mentality, materiality. So what is going on here is that they have, first of all, they have skipped the six sense fields, the six areas where the senses play. The word for sense base or sense field is ayatana, and ayatana literally means like a stretching out, a whole area, like a field of where you can experience things, like the field of vision is all the things you can see, right? It's the ayatana, it's a stretching out of the eye, the stretching out of vision, what you can see. So this is the meaning of that sal ayatana. Sal means six. Ayatana is the field, the six fields, or sense fields. Here it is, instead of showing the connection between the senses and the contact directly, it is going instead from nama rupa, from name and form directly to contact. And why is it doing that? And the reason it's doing that, it is showing us that there are two things that is necessary for us to contact the world. Two things are required. First of all, like the physical, organism, all the aspects of the physical body which are there to enable us to see, right? To be able to see, you have to have the eye, you have to have the nervous system, you have to have the brain functioning. All of these things have to be there for us to be able to see. Right? That's the physical thing. And when it says here, impingement contact, that's what it means. Impingement contact is like a form outside, a vision, a kind of something external to us, coming to the eye, impinging on the eye, hitting the eye quite literally. And it has to be that to hit the eye in that way for contact to be possible. If the eye wasn't there, if we lack the physical aspect of things, you can't see, right? This is what it's saying here. It's saying that if there is no eye, well, that's it. You can't see anything here. But to be able to see, there's also necessary to have the mind in the background. The mind is what makes sense of the sight, right? The mind is what kind of names things. So when I sit here, I can see all these things. And the reason I can recognize things is because of that naming ability or naming faculty of the mind. I can see bricks. I can see people. I can see ceilings, windows, and all of these things. And that is because the mind designates this. This is called designation contact, because you give a name to things. This is designation contact. And both of these things are necessary for sight to be possible, for hearing to be possible, for smelling something to be possible, both the mind and the physical sense has to be part of this. And this is interesting to some extent, because what it means is that how we see the world, how we perceive the world through the senses, is not something that is given. It is not absolutely constant. It is not always the same. Right? It depends on the mind which receives that information. How do we name it? How do we look at it? How do we designate it? How do we deal with this information? This is an important aspect of how we perceive things through the senses. And I'm sure you will all know that that is true, right? We know that sometimes two people see exactly the same thing, and if they're asked to describe it afterwards, they describe it in very different ways. This is a very well-known phenomenon. It's well-known, for example, in the justice system, where you have witnesses to incidents, and this is different witnesses to the same incident. It's as if they describe two different realities, right? As if they've got nothing to do with each other. And that is because we interpret the world often so differently. Or you can know it also just within your own experience. That, you know, you wake up on a day, and one day you're very happy and the world looks bright and everybody is nice and you love everyone and everything is great. That is like a good day you wake up, and then other days you wake up, you're really grumpy and negative and everybody seems just difficult and everything life is miserable as a consequence. But still, the world, the things out there are the same, if you want to put it that way. But we are filtering it through the mind in a different way, so things look different. Or you come out of a nice state of meditation and the world looks brighter, the colors look brighter, the world looks more sunny, the sun is more sunny, and the world looks better because our mind is calm and peaceful. We are receiving the external input in a different way. People seem more friendly, more lovable, because we come out of a meditation state. Everything is changed because of that. So how we receive the input from the outside matters enormously. And of course, what that means is that the sensor, even though we are born in the human realm, it doesn't mean that we experience everything always in the same way. We can experience things in new ways, depending on how we develop our mind. So by developing the mind, our experience of the human realm actually changes as a consequence. And that's great, right? This is very important. Input from the senses isn't static, it is not a given. It is something we can manipulate, and we can deal with it by using our mind in skillful and wise ways. And one consequence of that is that famous simile, the simile of the lump of salt, that you have probably, many of you will have read probably. The idea of the lump of salt is that the karma that we have to experience is not fixed, right? So if you make a lot of good karma, and you, it means basically you purify your mind, you lift your mind up, and you create a different mental environment for yourself, then our experience of the bad karma we have to experience is much less. Like the simile of the salt, the lump of salt put in a glass of water, or the same lump of salt put in the river Ganges, right? The water symbolizes the good actions. The salt symbolizes the bad actions. If it is a glass of salt, a glass of water, the salt, the water is very salty, is undrinkable. You put it in the river Ganges, you can barely taste it at all. Ultimately, you can't taste it at all. That's the same kind of thing. It's how we develop the mind. We experience the world according to how we develop the mind. So this is an important thing to realize. The world isn't static. Sometimes the world feels static. This is part of the problem of the sense of self. We think that the way things are now is the way they always have to be. We have a tendency to believe that this is the way it is, and we forget how incredibly malleable it is, how changeable it is. And by understanding that, we have more a stronger motivation to go on with developing our minds, because it actually transforms our reality into a more positive, brighter, happy reality because of that. So this is the point here of contact. Contact is not a given. Contact itself depends on how we receive these contacts in the mind. And that is what this is basically saying. But the way it is saying it, you sometimes be hard put to know that actually what's going on here. That's actually what is happening in that in that little extract from the Mahanidana Sutta. So this is contact, right? Then we can move on to the next factors here. So once we contact the world, one aspect of that contact is feeling, right? Contacting always has feeling coming together with it. When you have an experience, every experience has feeling tone to it. It either feels good, it feels bad, or it feels kind of like nothing, like neutral or whatever. So feeling comes always with contact. And because we feel, feeling, of course, is something that is very close to us. We want to feel good feelings. That goes with the very with the territory of feeling, because we want good feelings, we don't want bad ones. We tend desires arise as a consequence. We want to get rid of the bad feelings and we want to hold on to the good feelings. So this is what is happening next year. Contact is the condition for feeling here, and feeling is the condition for craving here. And with the cessation of contact, there is the cessation of feeling here. And with the cessation of feeling, there is the cessation of craving. So, fairly straightforward. And then we can again see that the definitions here of these things are fairly not perhaps all that interesting, but anyway, I have written them, add them to here. So, what Bhikkhus is feeling, there are the six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, feeling born of nose contact, feeling born of tongue contact, feeling born of body contact, feeling born of mind contact. This is called feeling here. And what Bhikkhus is craving, there are these six classes of craving here. Craving for form, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for taste, craving for tactile objects, and craving for mental phenomena. This is called craving here. So that, again, it shows you that all craving and all feeling is included. That's really all it really shows you, this particular definition. It doesn't really show you much beyond that. Of course, craving is sometimes instead classed as craving for sensual phenomena, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence, right? Like we saw yesterday. So that is the alternative definition. But they are almost like just alternative definitions of craving. I don't think they have all that much difference to them. If anything, this definition here is a bit more all-encompassing. It encompasses all craving, whereas the other one is a bit more narrow and specific for the type of craving which drives our existence in samsara, drives samsara forward, right? This is specific to those cravings, kama tanha, craving for sensual objects, for existence and non-existence. So this is, one of the important points here is that feeling is like, in a sense, one of the most important aspects of our existence as human beings. Feeling is very important because it is feeling that kind of is the thing that we always react to. This is the most important thing that we always react to with desire, right? All the other aspects of existence are kind of neutral until they get that feeling tone imbued in them. It's only when we see something and it gives rise to a feeling that really matters to us. If it doesn't give rise to a feeling, it's nothing. Oh, it's a lovely sight, right? The loveliness of a sight is a positive feeling. Oh, what a terrible sound. It's the terribleness of the sound which is the problem, not the sound itself. So it is the feeling aspect of existence. It's really the core thing here. And that is what makes whole of dependent origination actually continue going round and round. And this is what it says here in this little paragraph I have copied out from another sutta. It says that the Buddha says, "Now it is for one who feels that I proclaim, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering here, this is the cessation of suffering here, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering here." It is feeling which is the crucial issue. It is feeling which is the issue which makes the Dhamma possible and makes the Dhamma relevant. If there weren't any feelings, the whole thing would be kind of irrelevant. The feeling is this very important aspect of existence. And for that reason, you will often find that a lot of meditation, if you want to gain insights, the focus is often on feelings specifically. because if you understand feeling, you understand in a large extent how the world goes around, what happens, how, you know, why these things are so important to us. So insight is often done on feelings. And also this area, this conditionality from feeling to craving is also quite important, because obviously one of the things that we try to subdue a little bit from a Buddhist point of view is all this craving, right? Craving is problematic, craving leads to all kinds of, craving is desiring all kinds of stuff, desiring things we shouldn't really be desiring, right? And often that craving also leads to ill will, it leads to problems, it leads to violence, it leads to all kinds of difficulties in the world. So this link between feeling and craving is actually quite crucial. And a lot of our Buddhist practice is precisely in trying to tame the craving a little bit. This wild beast of craving which runs riot everywhere on the feelings and wants to do all kinds of stuff. But we're trying to tame it a little bit so it doesn't kind of run quite as much riot. And the way that we tame craving, of course, first of all, is by trying to be kind and not to be bad, right? This is the first way, by keeping the five precepts. You're already taming, you're taking the reins and saying, ooh, slow down a little bit, right? Let's not go there, because that's bad. Let's not go over here. Let's stay within these areas. And then just generally, by trying to be kind in the world, trying to understand people, trying to view things in the right way, we're trying to hold rein in the craving a little bit so it doesn't get as bad. So craving does not just depend on feeling, it also depends on our views, how we deal with the world, right? So if we look at the world in a certain way, craving will not be as strong. If we deal with it in a skillful way, then the link between feeling and craving will vary enormously depending on how we deal with the world, how we look at it, how we, etc., etc. So this is a very important part. And this is also an important part of this thing that is often called sense restraint in Buddhism. The Indriya Sangvara or Indriya Sangvara Sila, the habit of restraining the senses. And this is something I'm going to talk about afterwards. And the restraint of the senses, again, is to stop the mind from running riot in the world of the senses, to stop it from kind of having powerful desires, powerful aversions that lead you astray, and to have a mind which is more even and more calm. And when your mind is more even and more calm, it is easier to deal with it. It's easier to practice meditation properly. It is easier to, you have this evenness in life, and you, that means that it's, everything becomes easier as a consequence. And I will talk quite a bit about this idea of sense restraint, because it is very important, and it is very, quite different. The way this practice is quite different from what it sounds like. Sense restraint sounds like you have to grasp onto the senses and hold them back using a lot of willpower and force. But actually, the way it is described in many suttas is actually quite different from that. And it is based a lot more on the idea of wisdom rather than force. And I want to talk a little bit about what kind of wisdom that is and how we can exercise that. So this is a very important area, feeling to craving. Sometimes it is said that this is where you kind of break dependent origination, right? By being aware of feelings, you can break dependent origination here so it doesn't continue on to craving. I would rather say this is where you can kind of, you can calm down dependent origination a little bit. You can make the craving less, but you can't really break it completely at this point. Why? Because craving itself has a source, it has a cause, and that cause is avidya, it is delusion. And as long as the delusion is there at the root, at the base, even as an underlying tendency, craving will always come back again. Even if you can eliminate it for a short time, it will reappear again afterwards. So you can't really break the links here, you can't stop craving entirely from happening just by looking at these things in the right way. Really, the only place where you can eliminate dependent arising is by going back to the very beginning, to avidya, to delusion, to wrong view. That is where the problem starts, and that's where you stop the whole sequence from continuing here. Okay, so now we're going to look a little bit more at some practical suttas. And the next stage here is from craving. Craving is the condition for attachment or taking up or clinging, it says here, from taking things up. And with the cessation of craving, all this taking up of things stops as well. And here we have the definition of attachment or taking things up. And this definition is a little bit more interesting because it has a different type of content from the other ones. And what, bhikkhus, is this upadana, this taking up of things or grasping onto things? There are these four kinds of grasping here. Grasping to sensual pleasures or sensual objects. And the grasping to views, the grasping to... Excuse me. The grasping to rules and vows, and the grasping of the doctrines of the self. This is called grasping here. So here we are seeing, here we are moving from craving to the grasping of things. And the idea here is that if you have a lot of desires and craving in the world, one of the things you want to do is you want to make sure that that craving, those desires can be met, right? They get satisfied. You don't go around being unfulfilled, because having lots of unfulfilled desires is itself painful. If you think back to the first, to the noble truths we're looking at the beginning, not getting what you want is suffering, right? You have all these desires that are unfulfilled is problematic. So the idea of taking things up here is to like to devise strategies, devise ways, devise things that we can take and own, right? So we can have them, and then we can ensure that our desires are met as a consequence. And some of these things are fairly obvious. Like, you know, for example, we all have a home, right? A house or a home or whatever it is. And that is, of course, the house is a very important place for satisfying our basic desires. First of all, it's a place where we overcome a lot of suffering in the world. We get out of the weather, out of the elements. It's a place of safety from the rest of the world, if the rest of the world feels threatening or whatever. It's a place we can lock up so the thieves can't come in and kind of take all our belongings. So it's a place of safety and a place of refuge. So it actually satisfies a lot of this feeling, this craving not to experience unpleasant things. That's an important part of the having a home. But it's also a place where we satisfy a lot of our desires, right? This place where we eat, where we have kind of a nice, we decorate the house nicely, we have entertainments there. All of these things are kind of related to our home. And because of that, it is a place that fulfills a lot of the cravings and desires that we have in life. And for this reason, homes are very important to people, right? If your home burns down or it gets destroyed in one way or another, it is traumatic. Yes. All the contents, everything is gone. All of these things that were so important to us, it is very traumatic because we were holding on to that. We were attached to that. This is mine. This is my little playing area where I can ensure that my life is meaningful and I satisfy all of these problems, all of these desires and cravings that I have. So this is one way. This is the clinging to, large part, this is about sensual pleasures, right? Ensuring that our desire for sensual pleasures is met in one way or another. And of course, another way of doing that is to have a partner in life, to have a husband or wife or a partner or whatever type. It's the same kind of thing here. It is a place, there's a sense of ownership when you have a husband or you have a wife, right? When you get married, the idea of getting married is that it's like a contract, okay? You are mine, I'm yours kind of thing here. So there's a sense of ownership there as well. And again, it's the same kind of thing. Now you are my friend and my lover or whatever, and this is what a marriage or partnership is about. The same kind of thing to help us to satisfy those whatever desires and cravings are in that realm. So a lot of these things in the world, we make these ownerships, we become owner of things, we create boundaries. This is mine, this is what I take up, and this is how I ensure that that these desires and cravings get satisfied. So that is the craving, the clinging to sensual pleasures, attachment to sensual pleasures. It goes way beyond that, however. And next one here is the clinging to views. And these are all the views that we have about the world, whatever those views might be. Not so much the views about the sense of self, that is a separate thing here, but all other kind of views, right? Buddhism is the best, right? This is one of those views. Yeah, Buddhist teaching, wow, this is really good stuff. So it is one of those views. And it's true, it is good stuff, right? I agree, but still, it's like a view for most of us. Or views about anything, about politics, right, about the environment, I don't know about what. We hold views about so many things in this world. And we often grasp onto them, and it gives us a sense of identity. I am this. I am a Buddhist monk, right? Okay, so probably true in one way, but it's also an identity of who I am. I am born in Norway, or whatever. I live in Australia. All of these things give us a sense of identity. I come from such and such a family. They're really, all of these things are really just views in a certain way. But they are also a part of who we are, who we identify as. For that reason, we hold on to that, because it makes sense to us. But actually, one of the suttas, you know, we talk about giving things up, and one of the things that we do give up as we get into meditation, we give up a lot of this identity that we have, right? It's one of those nice things to give up, our sense of our background and our nationality and our education and our social standing and all that kind of stuff. As the deeper you go in meditation, the more you leave that behind, your sense of identity starts to kind of vanish almost. And it's very beautiful, because at that point, of course, it's much easier to have loving kindness and friendliness to everybody, because you're kind of erasing all those boundaries that normally divide us from each other. Your own sense of identity starts to perish. And wow, it's wonderful. You don't have to justify yourself to yourself anymore. You don't have to keep upholding this identity of who you are, thinking about yourself. You can let all that go. You are just a person. You're just a being. Nobody special, nobody specific, just this being, right? Just like everybody else. There's something very liberating about that, something very encompass everybody else. You can kind of, everybody else can be included as your friends and as your as people you can have compassion and kindness to. All these divisions that we have in humanity kind of get broken down as a consequence. One of the things that happen in meditation practice, so you can see how the clinging, the upadana, the attachments also, they go out the window as meditation deepens. This is one of the things you see when this happens. Then we have the clinging to rules and vows. This is the silabat upadana, or silabatta paramasa. This is something that was very strong perhaps at the time of the Buddha, and perhaps not so strong anymore these days. But in those days, they had all kind of wild ideas about how to practice the spiritual life. And there's some very entertaining examples of that in the suttas. There's a sutta called the Kukkuravattika Sutta. Kukkura means dog. Vatta is like the vow. So it is often called the dog duty ascetic, right? And the idea is that if you act like a dog all the time, then you're going to go to a good destination afterwards. And then there's the ox duty ascetic. You act like an ox all the time, right? And literally, they acted like oxen and dogs. That's literally what they did. They would walk around on all four. They would eat the food from the ground. They would curl up to sleep at night, right? And it was madness. And because of that, they thought, well, this is going to lead us to a wonderful heavenly realm if we act like a dog and an ox. This is a classic example of silabat upadana. And then they come to the Buddha and they ask the Buddha, well, you know, obviously, they're not quite sure about this, right? Because the logic isn't very strong. If you act like a dog, you're going to end up in heaven. Well, so they ask the Buddha about this, and the Buddha says, well, I got some bad news for you. And it's quite funny, but I'm sure in those days it was very serious. But for us, it looks kind of funny when you look at it these days. But of course, this is a tendency in the human mind, so we also have that tendency to some extent. It's very easy to think of this as kind of a primitive way of looking at the world, but it's all there in us somewhere. It's just that we have kind of overcome it to some extent. And sometimes, you know, you see people doing their meditation practice, and every day at a certain time they sit down to meditate, which is great. But sometimes that too can become like a ritual, right? This is going to take me in a good direction. This is good for me. It's going to purify my mind. But sometimes you don't really, you stop reflecting whether you are doing it in the right way, whether it actually is leading to an improvement in your character. And it becomes almost like a ritual that you do because you think it's going to be good for you. But meditation, remember, meditation works if it lifts up your mind, if it takes you in the right direction, if it makes your mind brighter and more beautiful, right? In the long run and the short run. That is how we know that it actually works. So it's important to always investigate, to look at ourselves, is it giving the results that it isn't giving? And if it isn't, why not? If it is, great, but if it isn't, why not? What is blocking us? What is stopping us from making progress? Not to ritualize these things. They're far too important to be ritualized. And then you can make so much quicker progress if you reflect on these things in the right way and use them in a good sense. So there's always... be careful, because these tendencies are there in the mind. It's easy to make rituals out of things and think that that is going to somehow make progress on the path. And then the last one is the clinging or the attachment or the taking up of doctrines of self, right? We have been looking at some of those doctrines of self earlier on today, the idea of eternalism, that the self is going to last forever, the idea of annihilationism. And sometimes these ideas of self, they become more concrete. There's a particular aspect in us that we take as ourself, right? One classical aspect that we take as ourself is the will, the doer inside of us. You can see how people in the world, they identify with a doer, right? When you do things, you feel alive. When you do things, you feel like you're expressing yourself, right? So you go out and you create stuff and you do stuff, and that's when you feel like you're real. And if you try to restrain somebody who is a big doer and say, oh, relax. No, I can't. I have to do. I have to act. Why is it that they have to act? Because they identify with the doer. They have become the doer. Whether they are the doer or not is a different matter, but they identify with that. And this is what this means in part, clinging to a doctrine of self, is identification with being a doer in the world. And this is very common, right? People are workaholics and all this kind of stuff. And that is often to do with identifying with the doer. But the most profound identification, of course, is with the knower. I am the one who knows. I'm the one who is aware. I'm the one who sees the world, who experiences all this stuff. This is who I am. This is the most profound identification, and where the real sense of self often gets stuck inside of us. I know these things. And sometimes we identify with the body as well, right? I am the body. More often we think that we own the body, but to some degree we also identify with it. We actually are the body. And perceptions can be identified with. I have certain perceptions. I'm a happy person, right? Or I am this kind of person. And you identify with some of the perceptions that you have about the world. And feeling as well can be taken up for this kind of idea. So it is about identification with things, who we think we are. And this identification with things, according to the suttas, maybe briefly I can mention it as well, is it usually takes four different ways that it's classified as. You identify with a thing, you are the thing itself, I am the doer. Or you are the owner of something, that's another way of identifying, I own this body, this is my body. So you are the owner, that's a kind of identification. Or you are within something, right? It's like there are these five khandhas. I'm not everything in these five khandhas, but I am a certain aspect of these five khandhas. So I am within this in a certain way. There are certain things that are within you. I am larger than something, but feelings are also part of me. So they are also inside there. These are, in brief, it's not so important. I'm just mentioning it because it's a kind of a standard way of definition in the suttas, that we relate to these five khandhas in a certain way as owners or as actually being those khandhas. That is how this clinging comes about, right? These ideas, these views about the world, the ownership of all these kind of things, ownership of views, ownership of things in the world, and even the holding on to rules and rituals and vows, it says here, rules and vows. And now I want to look at some more practical examples of what this clinging business really looks like. And there is a nice sutta I'm going to read out now. This is a very simple sutta. I don't think we'd be able to go through the whole thing because it's quite a long one. But it's very simple and very kind of charming sutta, in my opinion. And it's nice to kind of get back down to earth again after all the highfalutin philosophy. So now we're getting back to reality. And this is a sutta about King Pasenadi and his queen Mallika, two very famous characters from the suttas. And this is they are basically discussing this idea of attachment. This is what the sutta is all about. And it's simple, but the message is nonetheless very profound. Okay, so this is how this sutta goes. Born from those who are dear is the name of this sutta. Maitreya Nikaya 87. I don't have to comment too much. I'm mostly just going to read it out and then you can see what you think about it. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, a certain householder's dear and beloved only son had died. After his son's death, he had no more desire to work and to eat. He kept going to the charnel ground and crying, "My only son, where are you? My only son, where are you?" Right? This is what happens when you are really attached to somebody, when you really sorrow and you grieve very deeply. It is as life loses its meaning, right? You have no more desire to work and eat because life kind of has lost its meaning for you because your attachment was so strong. I'm sure you can identify with that at least to some extent. And you run around, all you want is to get your son back. But unfortunately, because the son is dead, there's nothing you can do about that. Then that householder went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side. And the Blessed One said to him, "Householder, your faculties are not those of one who is in control of his own mind. Your faculties are deranged." "How could my faculties not be deranged, Venerable Sir, for my dear and beloved only son has died? Since he died, I have no more desire to work or to eat. I keep going to the charnel ground and crying, 'My only son, where are you? My only son, where are you?'" "So it is, householder, so it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." So this is the challenge, right? This is how the Buddha sees the world. And it's so different. This is like turning the world upside down, as we often, as the Buddha often tends to do. And this is why the Dhamma can be so challenging here. Because normally when we think about those who are dear to us, the very word dear implies happiness, right? We love somebody, we are close to somebody, family members, friends, whatever they are, they give us happiness. That's why they are dear to us. And then the Buddha says the exact opposite. They lead to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And here this poor man, he's running around, completely deranged, doesn't want to eat, doesn't want to work, and still he doesn't really get it, right? He doesn't see that there is sorrow and lamentation and problems arising from this, even though he's actually in the midst of it. He's in the grip of that particular pain. But of course, he is, like many people are, he is in denial about what is happening here. And that is what we will see next here. "Venerable Sir, who would ever think that sorrow, lamentation, pain, and grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear? Venerable Sir, happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." Then, displeased with the Blessed One's words, disapproving of them, the householder rose from his seat and left. This is usually what happens, right? We don't want to hear it because we are so attached to this idea, so attached to this, even though we are in the middle of the problem, we don't want to hear anything about it. Now, on that occasion, some gamblers were playing with dice not far from the Blessed One. Then the householder went to those gamblers and said, "Just now, sirs, I went to the recluse Gotama, and after paying homage to him, I sat down at one side. And when I had done so, the recluse Gotama said to me, 'Householder, your faculties are not those of one who is in control of his own mind,' etc., etc." And the whole thing is repeated. And then at the very end, "Venerable sir, happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." Then, displeased with the recluse Gotama's words, disapproving of them, I rose from my seat and left. So it is, householder, so it is. Happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. Then the householder left, thinking, "I agree with the gamblers." So the idea here, the gamblers here, they just signify just the ordinary people in the world, right? People who are fairly simple, they're just spending, whiling away the day, gambling with dice, not really doing anything useful. They don't really have any real insight into the nature of existence. So you go to these ordinary people, that is the ordinary view of the world, the view which is not well considered, the view which is not yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, wise attention to reality. An important point here is, of course, to understand that when the Buddha says this, he doesn't mean to say that there is just sorrow and lamentation from having people that are dear to you. He's saying, well, this is a different aspect of this that we're not used to looking and seeing. Of course, there is some degree of happiness to be had from people who are close to us, family members, people who are dear to us. If there wasn't any happiness there, we wouldn't have them, right? We wouldn't have any family. We would just kind of live as hermits in a cave and never speak to anyone because there was just suffering to be had from other people. But the fact that there is some degree of happiness, that's why we have relationships, that's why we have families, that's why we have friends, that's why we have all of these things, because some degree of happiness is there. But the Buddha here is pointing out another side of this, and this is really the important point. And of course, that other side is where all relationships must end. They must always end with problems. The more attached you are, the closer that relationship is, the more suffering will eventually have to happen as a consequence of that attachment. That is kind of it's a bit bleak, right? It's bleak because if you have a bad relationship, okay, then it doesn't matter if it breaks up. But that's kind of pointless anyway. But if it is a really good relationship, then if it breaks up, that's when the suffering happens. So whichever way you look at it, there is going to be problems there. And it's always the end point, when it comes to an end, it always ends with the problems. So there's two sides. Everything has two sides. Nothing is very one-sided. So please keep that in mind here. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on. Eventually, this story reached the king's palace. Then King Pasena the of Kosala told Queen Mallika. Queen Mallika was his chief queen. So he says to her, "This is what has been said by the recluse Gotama, Mallika. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." And she replies, "If that has been said by the Blessed One, sire, then it is so." And then the king says, not very happy with that reply, the king says, "No matter what the recluse Gotama says, Mallika applauds it thus. If that has been said by the Blessed One, sire, then it is so. Just as a pupil applauds whatever his teacher says to him, saying, 'So it is, teacher, so it is.' So too, Mallika, no matter what the recluse Gotama says, you applaud it thus. If that has been said by the Blessed One, sire, then it must be so. Be off, Mallika, away with you." You can see the kind of little domestic scenes here going on, which is a very interesting, right? It kind of makes the suttas come alive. This sounds really real, right? This might very well have happened. You can imagine that. So, and this is one of the charming things about the suttas. They have this reality about them sometimes, which is kind of hard to miss. Okay, so then Queen Mallika was known in the suttas for being quite clever. And so then she, obviously her next job now is to find a kind of strategy for showing the king that there might be something to this. Then Queen Mallika addressed the Brahmin Nalijanga. Come, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One and pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and ask whether he is free from illness and affliction, and his health is strong and abiding in comfort, saying, Venerable Sir, Queen Mallika pays homage with her head at the Blessed One's feet, and ask whether the Blessed One is free from illness and abiding in comfort. Then say this, Venerable Sir, have these words been uttered by the Blessed One? Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. And then learn well what the Blessed One replies, and report it to me. For Tathagatas do not speak untruth. Yes, madam, he replied, and he went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said, Master Gotama, Queen Mallika pays homage with her head at Master Gotama's feet, and asks whether he is free from illness and abiding in comfort. And she says this, Venerable Sir, have these words been spoken by the Blessed One? Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. So it is, Brahmin, so it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. It can be understood from this, Brahmin, how this is the case. Once in this Savati, there was a certain woman whose mother had died. Owing to her mother's death, she went mad, lost her mind, and wandered from street to street, from crossroad to crossroad, saying, Have you seen my mother? Have you seen my mother? And it can be understood also from this, how sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. Once in the same Savati, there was a woman whose father had died, whose brother had died, whose sister died, whose son had died, whose daughter had died, whose husband had died. And owing to her husband's death, she went mad, lost her mind, and wandered from street to street, from crossroad to crossroad, saying, Have you seen my husband? Have you seen my husband? And it can also be understood how this is the case from the following. Once in the same Savati, there was a certain man whose mother had died, whose father had died, whose brother, sister, son, daughter had died, whose wife had died. And owing to his wife's death, he went mad, lost his mind, and wandered from street to street, from crossroad to crossroad, saying, Have you seen my wife? Have you seen my wife? And it can also be understood from this, how sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. Once in the same Savati, there was a certain woman who went to live with her relative's family. Her relatives wanted to divorce her from her husband and give her to another whom she did not want. Then the woman said to her husband, Lord, that's how women spoke to the husbands in those days. Lord, these relatives of mine want to divorce me from you and give me to another whom I do not want. Then the man cut the woman in two and disemboweled himself, committed suicide, in other words, thinking, we shall be together in the afterlife. It can also be understood from this, how sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. Then, delighting and rejoicing in the Blessed One's words, the Brahmin Nalijanga rose from his seat, went to Queen Malika, and reported to her his entire conversation with the Blessed One. Then Queen Malika went to King Pasenadi of Kosala and asked him, "What do you think, sire? Is Princess Vajiri dear to you?" "Yes, Malika, Princess Vajiri is dear to me." "What do you think, sire? If change and alteration took place in Princess Vajiri, would sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in you?" "Change and alteration in Prince Vajiri would mean an alteration in my life. How could sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair not arise in me?" Right? Change and alteration is kind of a euphemism for death or for some serious problems or a serious change in things. The princess leaving or becoming very sick or dying or something like that. So this is what he is responding to here. And then she says, "It was with reference to this, sire, that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. What do you think, sire? Is the noble queen Vasabha dear to you? Is General Vidudaba dear to you?" That's his son, General Vidudaba. "Am I dear to you? Are Kasi and Kosala, these are the kingdoms that he is ruling over, Kasi and Kosala, are they dear to you?" "Yes, Malika, Kasi and Kosala are dear to me. We owe it to Kasi and Kosala that we use Kasi sandalwood, wear garlands, scents, and unguents. What do you think, sire? If change and alteration took place in Kasi and Kosala, would sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in you? Change and alteration in Kasi and Kosala would mean an alteration in my life. How could sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair not arise in me?" "It was with reference to this, sire, that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear and rise from those, or in this case, that which is dear." So here we have gone through all the people, right? People are always on the top of attachments, that usually the things we attach to most is other people. But then he also talks about Kasi and Kosala, which are these large kingdoms that he ruled over. And Kasi is the same as the present-day city of Benares, Varanasi, on the river Ganges. And it was a place where, in those days, luxury goods tended to be traded. And so he was the owner of this capital of luxury goods. So obviously he was quite attached to that, presumably, being the king, and probably enjoying all those luxury goods. And then, of course, now the king is starting to get the message, right? He's starting to see what's going on. And then he says to his wife, "It is wonderful, Malika. It is marvelous how far the Blessed One penetrates with wisdom and sees with wisdom. Come, Malika, give me the ablution water." So he's going to perform some kind of ablution ceremony, right? To some kind of purification ceremony or whatever. I guess that's what they did in those days. Not really sure exactly what that is. But now he's changed. And this sutta probably shows you the beginning of the confidence and faith that King Pasenadi got in the Buddha. There are lots of suttas, nice little suttas, about the interaction between the Buddha and King Pasenadi. There's a whole Sanyutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya called the Kosala Sanyutta, which talk about the relationship between the king and the Buddha. Very nice suttas, quite a simple but always profound and beautiful message. So if you want to have a look at those suttas, I would recommend those. They're actually quite nice ones. So this is the beginning, right? And it's all due to the cleverness of his wife, Malika, who understood how to kind of bring him around. And that is, of course, one of the reasons why she was the king's favorite queen, because she was on the ball, as they say. Okay. So then the sutta ends. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala, he rose from his seat, and arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation, in anjali, towards the Blessed One, and uttered this exclamation three times: "Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Honored to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened." And that, of course, is Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. That is what that is. So that goes all the way, that exclamation goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha himself. Okay, so there you are. That is the sutta on the danger of attachment and the consequences of attachment. That it eventually, the more attached we are, the more sorrow, the more problems it will tend to lead to in the end, unless we have developed our mind well so as to reduce that dependency on external things for our happiness. Okay, so that is all for this afternoon, and I'll see you again this evening at 7:30.